Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
You look like an angel. Walk like an angel. Talk like an angel. But I got one. You're the devil in disguise. Oh, yes, you are.
Hello everybody, I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy, and today is October 10th, 2020. Welcome to the introductory episode of the Story of Nowhere podcast, a show about studying and subverting the strategies of tyrants. This show is named after a book, The Story of Nowhere, which was written by me. I hope that if you're listening to this, you've already read the book, as the podcast is going to be the long-form, detailed, deep-dive continuation of the book. If you haven't read it, there's really nothing to worry about. I've made it really, really easy to access. Ebook, audiobook, and paperback versions are all available at storyofnowhere.com, and only the paperback is going to cost you anything. Also, the audiobook is right there in my podcast feed right before this episode, so really, you shouldn't have any trouble finding it. So, if you're driving or mowing the lawn right now, go ahead and finish this episode, but I definitely recommend that you consume the book in one form or another before moving on to the next episode. Anyway, to quickly recap, the book is about utopianism, which I contend is the engine of tyranny. I show how the pursuit of a hypothetical perfect society can bring about the worst in people, and I offer a handful of historical examples to demonstrate this. Without rereading the whole book here, this is largely because utopianism, in practice, operates on the assumption that the ends justify the means. Perfection at any cost. If you're convinced you've figured out how to make the world a better place, what wouldn't you be willing to do? Lie? Steal? Kill? A good question to ask at this point might be, better for who? But unfortunately, that question always seems to be asked too late. Unfortunately, history shows us that utopian plans end in dystopian realities. But Jesus, don't get all bummed out already. The book isn't all about how bleak everything is. The last section of the book is all about productive solutions. I argue that the only reason crazy people's utopian schemes ever get off the ground in the first place is because populations are first made dependent. Dependent on a relatively small administrative class for what I call in the book, four cardinal points. These are food supply, wealth or value, education of children, and the consumption of information. My ultimate point is that if we can just become independent with regards to these four things, we would effectively neuter the capacity of future tyrants and utopians and whoever else might want to come along and ruin everything. So the last part of the book talks a little bit about these four cardinal points, and will hopefully encourage some people to take constructive action in some way or another. We can't expect to become totally independent overnight, of course, but as I say in the book, if all you can manage is a single herb plant in a pot, then grow a single herb plant in a pot. To paraphrase Confucius, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a little herb. Naturally, hidden beneath these four points is a hidden fifth cardinal point, which is physical self-defense. Now that's kind of implied if you ask me, because if you don't have physical self-defense, then you don't really have anything. Anyway, the idea is that independence from huge central systems is the cure to utopianism. Now, the book was written for the general public. It's not an academic book or anything like that. It's short, it's simple, and most of it reads like a story. Basically, it's a meta-history, about this underlying pattern we just can't seem to shake. The book is my exoteric presentation of this idea, intended to get regular people thinking maybe just a little bit more about their ideologies and the ideologies they encounter on a day-to-day basis. I'm not holding my breath, but I wanted it to be accessible to everyone, just in case. I also wanted the book to be of use to people who already were familiar with most, if not all, of the facts that I present, because what I was trying to do was offer a new meta lens through which those facts might be observed. Still, the book is merely an exoteric survey into the world of utopianism. The podcast, on the other hand, will explore its esoteric elements. So, in this show, we're going to dig into subjects only alluded to in the book, as well as subjects not alluded to in the book at all. But this is the introductory episode, and so for my own peace of mind, I feel that it would only be appropriate to go back over one section of the book. That's the section where I actually define the term utopianism. Utopia, aside from being a stripper's name, is, well, it's hard to define. Sort of. I mean, you can find a definition of the word in any dictionary, and most people already have a general idea of what the word means already. But these definitions are always pretty simplistic. Too simplistic, anyway, for a serious investigation into the matter. The online dictionary Lexico provides this definition of utopia: an imagined place or state of things in which everything is perfect. Here's how Merriam-Webster defines it. 1. A place of ideal perfection, especially in laws, government, and social conditions. 2. An impractical scheme for social improvement. 3. An imaginary and indefinitely remote place. These definitions are fine, I guess, and pretty much comport to what most people think of when they hear the word. But I like specificity, because I want it to be absolutely clear as to what I'm talking about. So, I came up with a more complex definition. Now, this was difficult at first, because when I got started, I was pretty much operating with the same general definition that most people share. In Utopian Thought in the Western World, written by Frank and Fritzi Manuel in 1979, the difficulty in properly defining utopia is remarked on. They say that, historically, utopia has been a sort of moving target. As times change, ideals change, and yet perfection, by definition, is supposed to be unchanging. Already we're getting a hint of the paradoxical nature of utopianism, and we haven't even defined the term yet. On page 5 of their book, they write, quote, "The bypassing of a rigid definition may distress some philosophical intelligences who demand that at the beginning of an inquiry its terms be spelled out in contractual language. But as the whole of this work is intended to endow the idea of utopia with historical meaning, those looking for a dictionary label or a pat phrase had better try elsewhere. Utopia acquires plural meanings in the course of our study, in which we presuppose the existence of a utopian propensity in man, as William James in his famous lectures assumed a religious propensity while pointedly refusing to define religion." Unquote. They're saying that, like religion, utopianism is a nearly universal aspect of human culture, and yet, also like religion, it always appears with certain cultural distinctions. So, while virtually all cultures might have something we'd call religion, some cultures worship an abstract, monotheistic deity, while others worship trees and stars and sometimes even certain people. These are very different systems, and yet they're both religion. Utopia is very similar. It comes in varying forms. For instance, there are utopians who want to recapture some sort of mythic or romanticized version of the past, and they'll often downplay the problems of the past and exaggerate the problems of change. At the same time, other utopians wish to start the world over again, to reinvent the wheel, as it were, and shrug off all the accumulated wisdom of those who came before, and dismiss all this as antiquated and oppressive. It's important to recognize that these are both forms of utopianism, as both are here in the United States right now. And of course, there are different sorts of utopians, in the sense that there are elites who genuinely believe they're creating a better world, and then there are those who know it's a scam and manipulate the average person's desire for a better future in order to run off with all the money. I'm talking about both kinds of people. As I've said, utopianism is the engine of tyranny, so I don't care whether some elite asshole genuinely believes in it or not. If they don't, they're cynically playing on people's instincts to want better lives for their children, and for that, they're just as bad as the true believers. This is serious shit, and it gets a lot of people killed. I may joke around and whatnot, but I'm not joking around. I could care less about what the intentions of the elites are. What I'm really concerned with is making sure that regular people don't buy into the utopian garbage that's peddled by the elites, whether they themselves believe it or not. I think that most people are sensible and practical, but it only takes a little bit of utopian ideology seeping into the minds of sensible people to make everything go bad real quick. An ounce of crazy goes a long way, and it only takes one fart to stink up a whole room. But back to the definition. As I began writing my book, I found, like the Manuels, that the universality of utopianism made it difficult to nail down a solid definition. Peculiar things are easy to define because they stand out, but things that are everywhere are hard to pinpoint because they blend into the background. They're hidden in plain sight. Though he was referring to murder, the totally real Sherlock Holmes had this to say on the phenomenon in A Study in Scarlet.
It is a mistake to confound strangeness with mystery. The most commonplace crime is often the most mysterious because it presents no new or special features from which deductions may be drawn. This murder would have been infinitely more difficult to unravel had the body of the victim been simply found lying in the roadway without any of those outre and sensational accompaniments which have rendered it remarkable. These strange details, far from making the case more difficult, have really had the effect of making it less so.
Despite the words of my hero Holmes, and in spite of the reticence of Frank and Fritz Emanuel, I insist on a clear and precise definition. Robert Heine, author of California's Utopian Colonies, which was published in 1973, says that a utopia, quote, consists of a group of people who are attempting to establish a new social pattern based upon a vision of the ideal society, and who have withdrawn themselves from the community at large to embody that vision in experimental form. Unquote. This is good. It's certainly more specific than the Lexico and Merriam-Webster definitions, and it's certainly better than no definition at all. In particular, I like it because it provides us with realizable conditions with which a utopian situation might be identified. First, people share a vision or plan for an ideal society. Second, this ideal demands new patterns of social behavior and interaction. Third, to meet these demands, believers remove themselves from the status quo in order to act out these new behaviors and, hopefully, realize their ideal. Even still, this definition leaves us wanting. The utopian's ideal demands certain modes of behavior, but doesn't this imply that there are assumptions being made about society and human nature itself? And just how exactly are social patterns of behavior changed anyway? It was while wondering about these things, while also studying the examples of utopianism that I had chosen for the book, plus just thinking about all this stuff constantly, that I finally wound up with the definition I provide in my book. It is, quote, "Utopia is the inherently and internally contradictory belief that a theoretical vision of an ideal society, based on ideological assumptions about human nature, can justifiably be implemented by way of deception and/or violence." Unquote. I know that's a mouthful, but hey, it's specific. And I think that if we break it down point by point, it's actually very clear. I have a whole section in the book devoted to doing just that, so be sure to review that if you need to. I'm not going to read that whole section here, but I will quickly summarize it. The definition is broken up into 5 points. First, utopia is a theoretical vision of an ideal society. This everybody already knows. Point number 2. Utopias contain within them ideological assumptions about human nature. In other words, utopias are built on definitive claims about our species and how we interact with one another. From these assumptions, the means to achieve the ideal are defined. So, 2 examples I offer in the book are the Soviet Union and the British Empire. On the one hand, the USSR operated under the assumption that human beings are totally malleable, that they're nothing more than the creatures of the society in which they live. So, based on that, it was concluded that if an egalitarian society were established, people would naturally conform and fall into place. On the other hand, British imperialists, specifically somebody like Cecil Rhodes, thought that human beings were rigidly stuck in their ways. The British were, by their very natures, the greatest peoples on earth, while other populations, like Africans for instance, were naturally and irredeemably inferior. Based on this warped perspective, it was concluded that for the sake of the world, Britain should reign supreme over all. Point number 3. Utopian schemes are carried out with deception and/or violence. This is where we move beyond theory and into practice. Regular people who are just living their lives need to be sold on these ideals and these assumptions. This is where deception and propaganda come in. The Soviets touted a bogus line of unity, while the British spun stories of their race's superiority. Of course, when and if this propaganda failed, neither regime would shy away from using violence against those who stood in their way. The Soviets would regularly enslave, torture, and kill dissenters, and the British had no problem annihilating indigenous cultures, plundering resources, and starting wars to get their way. Point 4. Utopians operate under the assumption that the ends justify the means. Acts of deception and violence, which, when taken alone, any reasonable person would deem immoral, are justified in the minds of those possessed by a utopian ideal. This is simply because that ideal promises to be so great, so wonderful, that it'll be worth any cost imaginable. So the Soviets could lie to the people and eliminate troublesome citizens because the society that they were working toward would just be that good. Likewise, the British imperialists could destroy societies and take whatever they wanted because a British world would be the best world. Finally, point number 5, utopianism is inherently and internally contradictory. This just follows from all the other points. In point 1, we've got imperfect human beings postulating an ideal of the perfect, which is ridiculous. In the second point, we've got the same people making reductive claims about huge populations and then designing plans based on those claims, which is ridiculous. Points 3 and 4 we can take together. These people then imagine that by employing means that any sensible person would judge as bad, they can achieve not just good, but universally perfect results. And these bad actions are justified by the fact that they're committed in pursuit of the highest good. This is earth-shatteringly ridiculous. At every step, the whole thing is guaranteed to fail. And this would be funny, except that a whole hell of a lot of innocent people always seem to find themselves in the shadow of that collapsing edifice. As you can see, the Manuels were right about there being no tidy pat phrase to adequately define utopia. But hopefully I've conveyed a clear and specific definition of the term, even if it isn't simple. Once again, there's a whole section of my book which goes into this definition in far more detail, so please revisit that for reference. I should also say that, even though I'm pretty confident in this definition, it is liable to change as I continue in my education and learn more about this thing that I describe as the engine of tyranny. Defining and discussing definitions is all well and good, and I think it's very important. But I also think that the best way to understand something is to actually see it in action. Therefore, the bulk of my book is about actual examples of utopianism. And that's also going to be a major aspect of this show going forward. I want to demonstrate my definition by providing examples. But now that I've gone over my definition, I want to tell you a bit about myself and about the show. I might as well start by telling you about how I came to this idea of utopianism in the first place. It all began in 2017, when I was working on a different book project, all about propaganda. It was right after the 2016 presidential election, which was such a shit show, pardon my English, that I figured a propaganda detection and avoidance manual might be a useful thing to write. So I got right on it. But as I wrote, I found myself venturing off into all kinds of different subjects. Subjects that were, let's say, cousins of propaganda, but still weren't directly related to the project at hand. But I was really interested in these other things, specifically cybernetics and totalitarianism. And these weren't the only things. I'd always been interested in a whole wide variety of topics, but I could never identify the thing that actually bound them all together. It was like I had my fingers splayed out into a bunch of different pies, but I couldn't feel the hand that connected them all together. Feeling aimless, I quit the propaganda book and took about a month to think. And it really drove me crazy. I mean, what's the point? What's it all about? What am I after? Why these things? What am I even interested in? Well, one night, I depressingly reread what I had written for my aborted anti-propaganda manual. There was a section toward the beginning, all about Plato's Republic. It was in there because, in that book, which everybody should read, Plato more or less introduces the concept of government propaganda. And he does so in the context of sustaining an ideal society, or a utopia, which he'd theorized. I don't know what happened, but suddenly it hit me. See, to that point, I had been thinking of utopianism as a tool of the propagandist, a tool to butter up the masses and take them for everything they've got, simple as that. But that night, it finally occurred to me that I had it all backwards. Utopianism isn't a tool of the propagandist. Propaganda is a tool of the utopian. Propaganda appeals to this strange sense of perfection that seems to exist within us all. I'll talk more on this in future episodes when I discuss the actual nature of propaganda in more detail. Cause, I mean, hey, you didn't think I got rid of all those notes for that book, did ya? But utopianism brought everything together. It was the hand that connected all my gangly, pie-sticky fingers. Propaganda, cybernetics, totalitarianism. Suddenly I saw that it was utopianism that they all shared in common. It was what I had been studying and critiquing all along, I just didn't know it yet. Utopianism also cleared up something that had been bothering me for quite a long time, but I won't get into that right now. I'll just say that it had to do with inspiracy, K. Iris Thay. Remind me to do an episode on that if you care. So I've already said that this show is going to be covering all kinds of stuff related to utopianism as I've defined it. This means we'll be getting into subjects like history, philosophy, mythology, religion, technology, science, media, culture, school, education, and of course, propaganda, cybernetics, and totalitarianism. I know that's a whole topical buffet, but all of these areas are relevant to a contextual understanding of utopian schemes, past, present, and future. That said, the podcast, like the book, isn't all about problems. I mean, sure, there's going to be a lot of talk about problems, because before we can hope to cure an ailment, we first have to diagnose it. But yeah, I'll be discussing solutions as well. In fact, the next episode, episode 1, will kick off a series on a particularly important solution, so hopefully people will like that. I'll tell you more about that at the end of this episode. There's one more thing I've got to say about the podcast in general. This whole theory of utopianism as an underlying pattern in history is a work in progress. This podcast is the real-time record of my own self-education. It's an ongoing time capsule, and I entertain no illusions of objectivity. Facts may be objective, but the selection of facts to cover is not. Commentary on those facts is not. To pretend otherwise is to either be deluded or to lie. Perspective is limited by definition. That's why we call it a point of view. Time is limited, and therefore the angles I approach information from will be as well. We've all just got to accept this and move on, and always think critically, because this is true for all media in all forms at all times. I'll learn as I go, and I'll make corrections as I go. I don't know where this show's going to lead me, and that's the most exciting part of sitting here and recording my episode zero. Nothing but potential here. I just can't plan too far ahead. I've tried that before, and it always ends in me going in a totally different direction. I'm just going to go where I need to go and let myself grow. So as for me, once again, my name is Dan, Danny, and Daniel McCarthy, but my friends call me on the phone. My book and this show have so far probably given you the impression that I'm not a huge fan of the government. That is correct. My cheesy answer to the question, "What political party are you?" is, I'm a rectumarian. I think politics is for assholes. But seriously, if I absolutely had to align myself with a political ideology, I'd have to go with anarchism or agorism. But I generally don't like to label myself with isms, and I know some people think that's just some wishy-washy, fence-sitting BS, but I've just honestly not read enough political theory to confidently and definitively plant my flag anywhere. And look, I'm 25, so frankly, I'm not sure that I've even been on this planet long enough to commit to some hard and fast ideology yet. I mean, isn't it kind of disturbing when somebody says something like, "I've been a Democrat since I was 18. It's like, oh, that's embarrassing for you. Ugh. So yeah, I'm not married to any ideology. But the political theory that I have read, coupled with my own natural proclivities, definitely makes me most comfortable in the anarcho-capitalist, voluntarist, agorist camps. And I should point out that statism and utopianism are almost inseparable. As any real anarchist will tell you, government is merely a monopoly on force in a given area. These special rights to violence for this one class of population managers is said to be justified by the social ideal they promise to uphold. Pretty much lines right up with our definition, wouldn't you say? So, am I saying that all states are utopian schemes? Yeah, I guess I am. But just because all states are utopian schemes doesn't mean that all utopian schemes involve a state. There are certainly anarchist utopias, like communism, ironically. In sum, I'm not a card-carrying anything, but I'm also definitely not what you'd call a moderate. So there's politics. How about religion? That's sure to come up. Personally, I'm not religious, just like most people who were raised Catholic. I'm not an atheist either, but Jesus, maybe I am just an annoying fence-sitter. But hey, honestly, I've actually developed an appreciation for religion that I really didn't have when I was younger. I respect the community and the charity, and that odd contentedness that the genuinely religious people seem to have. I also like that genuinely religious people have a respect for something transcendent, and I like that they bow to an authority that's outside of and bigger than the state. And that's why I absolutely hate that lame, evangelical, Operation Iraqi Freedom George W. Bush Republican megachurch Christianity. God, I mean, what's the point in even having a religion if you're just gonna wind up worshiping the flag? I'm just kidding. I know the point. Read Plato's Republic, or my chapter on the Republic, and then you'll get it too. So now I've pissed off the regular political people and regular religious people, and it's not even episode one yet. Good. I'm vetting my audience and making sure only the riffraff get in. Anyway, I am genuinely interested in religion because I'm interested in history and philosophy and psychology. Obviously, you can't really ignore religion when you're into that kind of stuff. Also, I don't like to brush it all away as stupid superstition. I think it's probably pretty meaningful that virtually all cultures have religious traditions, and often these traditions are quite similar across cultures, you know? I mean, that's pretty interesting. I actually think there might be something to perennialism and syncretism, though I'm also aware that these things can be used for nefarious and utopian purposes. I also find esoteric stuff really fascinating, that stuff that some people would call the occult. But no, I don't have, like, Hebrew letters tattooed on my chest, and no, I'm not into crystals or horoscopes or any of that stuff. I just think that certain esoteric, alchemical stuff is really quite interesting, and I'm sure I'll talk about that on the show. Alright, so politics, religion, I mean, man, what else is there? Oh, right, so I'm not qualified to talk about anything. I'm not some college degree person or anything like that. I went to community college to get free rent, and I hated it, just like I hated regular school. Got in the way of my education, you know? Now I work at a factory, and I do all this nerd shit on the side because it's what I love. And I happen to think it's important. I've said it a million times in this episode already, and I'll say it again. Utopianism is the engine of tyranny, and tyranny is really, really serious. But I don't have some piece of paper granting me the authority to talk about history or philosophy or bubblegum flavors in the 1950s, which means that I'm going to have to be extra good about citing my sources and backing up what I say. You know, that stuff that experts should do, but often don't have to, because people just take them at their word because they're experts. Yeah, well, I can't do that, because I've got no laurels to rest on. And I'm happy about that. I think it'll make for some primo content. But enough about me. Tell me a little about yourself. I'm just kidding, this is a one-way microphone. So before I wrap up, I'd like to extend some gratitude where it's due, and thank some of the independent media creators who inspired me to start my own show. First of all, I've got to thank Brett Vinat of the School Sucks podcast, schoolsucksproject.com, which, if you don't listen to the School Sucks podcast, somebody should take your little smartphone away from you because you're using it wrong. Also, thank you to Kevin Cole of unityofthepolis.com. These two fine gentlemen are my cohorts on another show I do that's been going on for about a year and a half now, called In Pursuit of Utopia, which you can find out about at storyofnowhere.com. It's really great for a lot of reasons, one of which is the fact that it got me in front of a microphone. Or is it behind a microphone? Whichever. I speak into a microphone on that show. So it really got me comfortable in the world of podcasting. And for those two guys, who I'd looked up to for years, to do a show with me is just the greatest thing ever. 4 years ago, me would be so proud. So thank you, Brett and Kevin. Now, I can't even express the gratitude owed to Richard Grove and Lisa Arborcheski. Their content over at tragedyandhope.com has been of endless value over the years. But more recently, their course Autonomy really got me moving on this whole project of mine. This course fits so perfectly in with the solutions I'm driving at in my book. I mean, specifically, it's all about cultivating your own valuable skills and abilities to escape the proverbial rat race. You can find out more about Autonomy at storyofnowhere.com if that sounds interesting to you. What Rich and Lisa have built is truly wonderful, and without it, I don't know that I'd be doing this right now. So thank you both very, very much. And of course, there is the illustrious and insurmountable Chris McMillan, the man behind the Truth Conduit podcast at truthconduit.com. Chris and I met in Richard Groves and Lisa Arborcheski's Autonomy course, and Chris pretty much started his own podcast on, like, day one. It was inspiring to see him taking action and producing some great content, and the competitive little bastard in my brain made me want to catch up with him and start my own show. So here I am, officially declaring a podcast rivalry between Chris and I. I don't know exactly what that means, but to hell with it. First day, start a war. Sincerely, though, Chris has had me on his show a number of times, and it's always great fun. And he's been super helpful in getting me to promote my work, and he was even a proofreader for my book. So thank you, Chris. Other content creators that I've had less direct contact with, but still have influenced me in no small way, are James Evan Pilato of Media Monarchy, James Corbett of The Corbett Report, Prof. CJ of the Dangerous History Podcast, Thaddeus Russell of the Unregistered Podcast and Renegade University, and Scott Hambrick and Carl Schutt of the Online Great Books Podcast. So thanks to all these folks, and if you're out there in the audience and you're not familiar with any of the names you've heard in the last few minutes, I really highly recommend you do something about that, because this is where the good content is coming from. In conclusion, here is what you can expect in the next episode. Episode 1 will kick off what will most likely be a 5-part series called A Brief History of Critical Thinking. Of course, I think that critical thinking is a powerful antidote to utopianism and tyranny, so I figured it would be an appropriate subject to cover right out of the gates. But there's already plenty of stuff online about what critical thinking is, how it's done, stuff like that. But what I couldn't really find online was a decent history of critical thinking. Where does it come from? How did it develop? How has it changed? How has it stayed the same? So I figured, hell, rather than be redundant and rehash all the great work on critical thinking that people have already done, I'll take the path less traveled and do a history of critical thought. So that's what's going to get started next time. If you're an overachiever and interested in some preparation for that, in this episode's show notes, I've included some material about what critical thinking is and how it's done and all that good stuff. The show notes are, of course, available at storyofnowhere.com, where you can also find new episodes of this show as they're posted, multiple versions of my book, and get access to In Pursuit of Utopia with Brett Vinat, Kevin Cole, and myself. Well, folks, that about wraps up episode 0. I'll leave you with a somewhat interesting thought. They say that the more you do something, the better you get at it. So, theoretically, the longer a podcast goes, the better it'll become. That means that, if I do my job right, this will be the worst episode of this podcast I ever do. The next episode will be the second worst, and so on. Isn't that exciting? So keep your eyes peeled for The Story of Nowhere, Episode 1, A Brief History of Critical Thinking, Part 1, Shamans, Seers, and Sacred Geometry, my second worst episode ever. Tune in and find out if that little bit there is actually logically valid or not. Thank you all for listening. Now I've got to hurry and get to bed, because tomorrow I'm getting married. Toodaloo! You're the devil in the sky. Oh, yeah.